Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 251, and the British invasion of Zululand is in its first week. The grey vultures of Undini on a march to Sandlwana, where pride met prophecy. King Cetshwayo Kampandi had prepared his people for war, and here it was, courtesy of Governor Sir Bartle Frere and led by Lord Chelmsford. After overrunning KwaZulu-Natal, the home of Sihayo, Commander Chelmsford was on the move. It was therefore a sort of rough justice that Cetshwayo had decided to send the bulk of his army to operate in Sihayo's district. The Zulu army had been richly prepared for war, marching off towards Chelmsford's invading column on Friday, the 17th of January, 1879. Their Nokenke regiment at the front. The army marched 10 kilometres in a great single file and then bivouacked in the Amankosini Valley after crossing the White Umfolozi River. If you recall last episode, I explained how Lieutenant Colonel Glynn had led the central British column until Lord Chelmsford arrived at the jump-off point at Help Makar. Help each other, it means. Lord Chelmsford, though, just couldn't help himself. He began to micromanage the invasion and sidelined Glynn and his officers. On the other side, the Zulu column also had two commanders, managing the regiments jointly. Chief Nchingwayo Kamaholi Khoza of the Kwaqhikazi and Chief Mavumingwana Kaindlela Ntuli of the Utulwana. Nchingwayo was almost 70 years old, and being older, his voice would usually sway any decisions. He may have been aged, but he was extremely powerful, short and thick-set, like a modern rugby prop with the great thighs of most of the male descendants of Senzangakona. Not only was he a great warrior, he was also a wonderful orator. His speeches, mellifluous and motivational, he had the gift of the gab. Chief Mavumingwana was brother of the Isukulu Godide of the Ntuli, who was going to lead a separate column of Zulu warriors heading off to face the British right column crossing the Tugela. Mavumingwana and Godide's father was Ndlela, who was Dingane's chief and Nduna, the family therefore having a long relationship with Zulu royalty. Furthermore, Cetshwayo regarded Mavumingwana as a close friend, even though he was one of the chiefs who had preferred a policy of appeasement with the British rather than outright war. He had changed his mind by now, but it must be said that Zulu leadership was prepared to debate strategy, unlike the British. The officers of the English military establishment were supposed to seek points of view, but as you're going to hear, often the bewhiskered, ego-riddled Victorian general failed to think logically and reacted like an outraged teen on TikTok when their decisions were questioned. As the various regiments set off, Cetshwayo embedded Ntuzwa Kainhlaka in the army as his eyes and ears. Ntuzwa's brother was Chief Sekatwayo of the Umdlalozi, another highly trusted clan and regiment. Ntuzwa was a neutral observer, and he would report directly to Cetshwayo on the Zulu commander's performance. While there's been some debate on the size of Cetshwayo's army, it is generally believed to be in the region of 24,000 warriors. Cetshwayo's youngest brother, Prince Nugwende Kampande, joined in this march, as well as Kwano Dwengu Induna, Mawundula Kamamba, and Vumandaba. The latter had personally received the January 11 ultimatum from the British and led the Umkliyu regiment. Also marching into the annals of epic history, Sikwele Kwele, who commanded the Ingoma Makosi. If you recall an earlier episode, Sikwele Kwele had been exiled and disgraced after the stick fight that turned into a spear fight with the Utulwana at the Umkhosi gathering of December 1877. Zibebu was there, the ambitious chief who considered himself the equal of Cetshwayo. He brought thousands of warriors from Udloko. Some of the warriors, particularly the eldest amongst these Amabutu, had remained at their homesteads as a local force in case the British appeared, as they had with Sihayo's KwaZulu-Natal. News of the burning probably reached Sihayo and his other sons at Undini within 24 hours of the 12th of January British attack. Grim news indeed. His homestead reduced to ash, his cattle driven away, spoils of war. When word arrived, it fell among the assembled chiefs around Cetshwayo with the force of a British 7-pounder shell. Yet, amid the shock, the attack revealed something valuable, a glimpse into British intentions, a pattern beginning to emerge. The king had been meeting daily with his counselors and trusted advisers, gathering in the early morning cold. The chiefs wrapped themselves in grey trade blankets against the chill. Ordinary Zulu called these men amanqe, vultures, for the way they huddled together, their grey wings folded close, as if sheltering behind something precious or contemplating something grave. The story about Kwasokhekle had rippled down the length of the border and high up on the hills above the Middle Drift. Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Durnford's men were there, and they picked up a change in mood of the Zulu communities, scanning the landscape through their field glasses from the other side of the Tugela. The countryside seemed to have suddenly emptied ominously. The elders, along with the women and children, left their homesteads and retreated into the mountains or deep into the thick Zululand bush. On the morning of the 13th of January, Lieutenant Colonel Durnford received an ominous report the day after Chelmsford's attack on Kwasokhekle in the Batche Valley. Durnford was leading No. 2 Column in the vicinity of Middle Drift along the Tugela border near Kranskop, a force of mounted men, a rocket battery and three battalions of the Natal Native Contingent. An Amabuto of some strength had apparently been spotted on the Zulu bank of the Tugela at Middle Drift, and they were poised to strike into Natal. This information had been relayed to Durnford by the Norwegian Mission Society's Bishop Hans Schroeder, who was at Ntunjambili near Kranskop. He had moved across the border when war became likely, and like many missionaries, he played a double game. He had remained on good terms with Cetshwayo after King Impande's death, but behind the scenes he was lobbying for Natal's intervention in Zululand. Cetshwayo had left many of the border regiments in place here, including the Amatlube in Nkandla and the Ntuli and Magwaza at Middle Drift, and the English spies were sure they were mobilizing to cross into the colony. Earlier, Chelmsford had ordered Durnford to march north to support his crossing of Rorke's Drift, and Durnford duly marched north. Then Chelmsford changed his mind and told Durnford to reverse order. So on the morning of the 13th, Durnford's units had become quite scattered towards the Middle Tugela and from his old headquarters at Dalmain's farm close to Izandlwana. "Time for action," he thought. He scribbled a hasty dispatch to Lord Chelmsford, telling him of his intention to move down the escarpment in order to thwart a possible invasion of Natal. The problem was the intelligence he had received from the bishop was utterly incorrect. Colonists often overreacted to reports of invasion, and this was one of the moments. Durnford told his men to be ready to march out at 2 a.m. the next day, the 14th of January. Heavy rains had fallen along the Tugela, so crossing at any point would be tricky for either the Zulu or the English. Chelmsford told Durnford that he should operate with a degree of flexibility when receiving accurate information. The bishop was a trusted source, but he was the only source. There was no corroborating data, no sign that the Amabuto were about to invade. Durnford had spent a few tantalizing weeks in which it appeared that the Anglo-Zulu War was going to be fought and ended while he and his men idled the time away border patrolling. You remember his reputation had been tarnished by the Langalibalele affair a few years earlier, and he was hoping to restore his good name with a glorious feat of arms. Fate had apparently handed him that moment. His troops got up before 2 a.m. and began preparing to leave at dawn, ready for the long descent down into the Tugela Valley, when a dispatch rider galloped up with new orders and a terse message. The officers watched Durnford as he opened the dispatch. His gaze hardened and a look of disgust flickered across his face. The dispatch in part read, "Dear Durnford, unless you carry out the instructions I give you, it will be my unpleasant duty to remove you from your command and to substitute another officer for the command of No. 2 Column." Chelmsford went on to point out that if anyone acted separately from the other parts of his force, like a loose cannon, merely because reports hint at a chance of an invasion of Natal, it could jeopardize the entire mission. A right royal telling off, as they say. But Chelmsford then muddied the waters with this line, which was to cause much of the following disaster. "I am quite right to give its commander every latitude and would expect him to disobey any orders he may receive from me if information which he obtained showed that it would be injurious to the interests of the column under his command. So which was it? Durnford neglected to obey my instructions in this present instance and has no excuse. Chelmsford was reacting to fighting wars in South Africa. The experience in the Eastern Cape of chasing the elusive Xhosa around the Amatoli Mountains during the Ninth Frontier War had angered and drained him, particularly when the colonial detachments tended to ignore his strict orders. South Africans, you know, hard to control. Here was Durnford leading a large group of colonial mounted horsemen, half colonial himself, going off at a tangent. This kind of thing had to be nipped in the bud. As it turned out, the circumstances in which Chelmsford would allow a column commander to act independently had been duly noted by Durnford, while it also finally solved a little riddle. Up to now, Durnford's men had sort of dangled between Lieutenant Colonel Pearson's troops, who crossed the Tugela at the lower drift near the coast, and were heading towards Gingindlovu and Glynn's column further north. On the 15th of January, Durnford was ordered to move back to Rorke's Drift, with his headquarters, his mounted troops, his rocket battery, and one of his strongest battalions of Natal native contingent troops. Two other NNC battalions were left behind in Krauskop to guard the border. Also on the 15th, after dashing off new orders to Durnford, Chelmsford and the Central Column closed in on Sipesi Mountain, which was 30 kilometres away, as they advanced from Rorke's Drift heading east. He sent out a large patrol of mounted men under Colonel Russell to reconnoitre the track to Sipesi. Russell returned and reported the area appeared deserted, no sign of the Zulu army. The road, however, he said, was impassable, muddy, wet from recent rains. Evelyn Wood, by now, who led the smaller column 4, was off on the left, about 40 kilometres further north, harassing Zulu homesteads on the Middle Ngomi River area. It was going to be a staged advance, Chelmsford reported in a dispatch to Sir Bartle Frere. Our first move must therefore be to Sumblana Hill, where there is wood and water. Sumblana? He would eventually get the spelling right, but for all the wrong reasons. To his south lay the deep and dark forest at Kudeni, and the British feared that the Zulu would enter the forest and outflank their forces unseen. Kudeni is a stone's throw from that other infamous location, in Gandla. Rivers like the Manyani, the Nsuzi, the Mfunkosi, the Mpopoma, they all rush down deep ravines here into the Watamfolosi and the Tugela and the Mhlathuzi. As the British had discovered to their detriment fighting an agile mobile force inside riverine thickets, it was often a nightmare. Macoma had shown that recently in the Ninth Frontier War in British Kaferia. On the 16th of January, Chelmsford rode out from Rorke's Drift with his staff and a light escort to inspect things himself. That was taking a chance. He had no idea where the Zulu army was. Here was the commanding officer of the invading force taking a recce. He stopped to inspect the British camp on the Batshe River, located halfway between Isalwana and Rorke's Drift. Major Dunbar of the 2nd and 24th Regiment of Foot was in charge of the camp. Dunbar was dispatched with four companies of his battalion and some native troops to repair the old wagon road and establish a depot for firewood, a critical logistical source. Major Dunbar was a highly experienced officer, having served in the Crimean War 20 years earlier. His discomfort with the position of his camp was based on sound military judgment and led to an unsavoury confrontation with Chelmsford's staff. Dunbar, you see, was ordered to pitch his tents beneath a rocky outcrop and in heavy thorn bushes, a position that offered no field of fire, meaning his troops would have a limited ability to defend themselves effectively against a sudden attack by massed ranks of AmaZulu, which was their favourite method. He was forced to mount strong guards nightly with men who had already been working all day, further straining his resources, so that when Chelmsford pitched up on the 16th, Dunbar let it be known that the position was unsuitable and pointed to a better spot across the Batshe that had a wider field of fire. He was a highly decorated veteran, respected, no coward. Chelmsford turned to discuss Dunbar's suggestion with his officers and Chief of Staff Krellock, who had already been writing missives back to London attacking Colonel Glynn, said audibly,
"If Major Dunbar was afraid to stay there, we could send someone who was not."
Dunbar stiffened and walked away. Later that day, he wrote to Chelmsford, resigning his command. The story spread among the officers of the 24th, worsening the already bad relations between the headquarters staff and Glynn's column command. Chelmsford personally intervened, persuading Dunbar to retract his resignation, but the damage had been done. By the 18th, the second column had reached Sunspreit and Vermaak's farm at the top of Helkmakar Ridge. Yeah, the weather closed in again. It may have been midsummer, but a bitingly cold wind whipped across the open veldt. This was the same day that Gajroyo Kampande's main army had completed its second day of marching. On the first day, the 17th, 24,000 men had walked 10 kilometres, slowly heading in the direction of Chelmsford's men. Interviewed later, Ukandampemvu Mabuto chief Umhlahlana Nguni said Gajroyo had briefed Izokozi and said, "I am sending you out against the whites, who invaded Zululand and driven away our cattle. You are to go against the column at Rourke's Drift and drive it back into Natal. You will attack by daylight, as there are enough of you to eat it up, and you will march slowly so as not to tire yourselves." The Zulu army could march up to 30 kilometres a day when demanded, but on the 18th they advanced only 14 kilometres to the Isipesi Ikanda near the Mpembeni River. Such a powerful and vast army left its mark on the landscape. The bush was flattened, the grass trodden down. For 5 months, their footsteps could be tracked over the ground. The wet weather failed to dampen neither Durnford's men nor Gajroyo's. On the 19th of January, the impis split into two columns, which advanced parallel to and in sight of each other. Inchingwayo the elder commanded the left and Mavumingwana the right. Both commanders and their senior retinue had left Ondinga on foot, while the horses were walked behind. Gajroyo, ever the wily military man, didn't want the commanders moving too fast and tiring out the men before battle, so he made his chiefs walk with their warriors. A few mounted Zulus scouted ahead, just as the British were doing. Gajroyo had appointed the order of the march himself, and for the honour of leading the way, the drinking of the dew of the early morning into the long, wet grass was a jealously guarded mark of favour. One of the younger Amabuta, the Nokenke, led by Umfolozi Umholopi, cracked the nod. As they marched, the men would sweep their shields over the top of the grass together so that from a distance they resembled cavalry, the shields swinging up shoulder high and moving to the rhythm of songs. The elder warriors preferred the longer shields, 1.25 metre long Isitlangu, whereas the younger carry the 1 metre long Mbumbulozi. Things had definitely changed since Shaka's time, and that was represented in the regiments. The shields previously of each regiment had been uniform, almost exactly the same colour and even pattern. 50 years later, the herds had been depleted, the hides were harder to come by. The most important colour was white, and the older chiefs had great gleaming white shields. Gajroyo now had been forced to allocate different patterns of colours to companies within each regiment. For example, the Ukandampemvu carried white shields with broad brown patches in the middle, or brown shields with little white patches on the side. For the youngest Amabuto, the Ngobamakosi and the Uve, they carried plain brown and black. What a sight this was! By midday, the dew of the morning was long gone. The warriors threw up clouds of dust, moving at their leisurely pace. Royal princes were there, Gajroyo's full brother Indabuko, his younger favourite brother Dabulomanzi, Prince Madwendu, Zibebu of the Mantlakazi as well, an army of national unity sweeping through the rolling hills, indignant and determined, impervious to doubt. Many looked about the throngs of powerful warriors and believed the fighting would last but a day. The scene shifts to Chelmsford once more. The morning of the 18th of January, 1879, Chelmsford and his staff had left the fuming Dunbar and the 24th and rode towards the mountain they saw in the distance, Isandlwana. So far, they'd seen nothing of significance, but that morning, things changed. They hadn't gone far when they ran across a herd of cattle in the road, being driven by herdsmen who said they were going to the British camp at Rourke's Drift. They were of Gamdana's Kakonga homestead. He was one of Sahayo's younger brothers, who lived in the broken country below Hlazakazi Mountain, a few kilometres away. "This was proof," said Chelmsford, "that the Zulu border communities were crumbling in the face of British power." "Gamdana," said Chelmsford, "should come and surrender in person. Face the music, old boy. Later, as Chelmsford and his group trotted along, they reached what one officer called a peculiarly shaped hill called Santa Juana. They halted, dismounted, and had breakfast. Another beautiful day in Africa, sunny and clear, and the track, they called a road, a thin ribbon of two overgrown wagon wheel ruts, led away in the tall grass stretching into the distance to Sepezi Mountain, its sides bloated like a fat whale, and blue-grey far in the distance Babanango shimmering in the haze. Riding towards the mountains still, they came across a large group of elders and women and children herding a vast herd of cattle south of Zandluana at Malakata Hill. Chief Gamdana rode up personally on his own horse and explained he'd been negotiating his surrender with Henry Francis Finn Jr., the border agent nearby at Msinga. Chelmsford was indignant. How dare junior administrators negotiate surrenders? That was his job. I was going to attack him, perhaps, said Chelmsford. This won't do. I have sent a summons to Mr. Finn to join me here at once, he sniffed to Sir Bartlefrere. Nevertheless, he told Gamdana to go to Rourke's Drift and give up some of his cattle. What was really going on, according to Zulu oral tradition, was that Gamdana was sick and tired of living in his overbearing brother Sihayo's shadow and was considering his stake in a post-war Zululand, hedging his bets, if you like. If the Zulu defeated the British, he could slip into the Badlands to the south and bide his time, and vice versa. Chelmsford still hadn't figured out, however, why Gamdana had no warriors with him, or very few. They, of course, were making their way towards the British at that very moment and were closer than 30 kilometres away. On the 19th of January, Cetshwayo's powerful Amabutu had marched 14 more kilometres and slept on the tableland east of Babanango Mountain. The Zulu scouts that climbed Babanango could see the British. Later, on that morning of Sunday, 19th of January, 1879, Chelmsford called in George Hamilton Brown, the commandant of the 1st Battalion, 3rd Regiment of the Natal Native Contingent. We met him last episode. He was also known as Maori Brown, owing to his service in New Zealand and the fact he could speak Maori. Chelmsford informed me that news had been received that the Zulu army was about to leave Ulundi that morning and attack us. We know, of course, that the Zulu army had left 3 days earlier and was now breathing down the British neck. What happened next is for next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favourite platforms. It helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'll load an update about various episodes. You can email me from there. Here is a late Victorian ironic goodbye. Until we meet again, may your conscience trouble you just enough to keep life interesting.